You're listening to the Arsenal for Democracy, forging and preparing a new generation for leadership. Now, here's your host, Bill Humphrey.
For 91.3 FM WVUD and WVUD HD1 Newark in the great state of Delaware, I'm Bill Humphrey, and thanks for listening. I'm coming to you on December 9th, 2013 from my studio in Newton, Massachusetts. Ahead this hour, I reflect on Nelson Mandela's legacy. Guest Neil Carter talks about millennials of color. Then I defend the minimum wage and unemployment insurance and more. Arsenal for Democracy is usually recorded in studio every Monday and is available for download on Tuesdays at arsenalfordemocracy.com and from iTunes and other locations. We air the show in Delaware on 91.3 FM on Wednesdays at 6 p.m. Eastern. Email us at afdradio@gmail.com or call and leave a message with your views and questions at 347-688-6676. This is the Arsenal for Democracy. From WVUD and ArsenalForDemocracy.com, I'm Bill Humphrey. You're listening to the Arsenal for Democracy. Most of the world has united this week to mourn the passing of South Africa's former president and anti-apartheid leader, Nelson Mandela. Global opinion is pretty consistently sure about how to come down on this one person's legacy, and that's favorably, as I think everyone has heard by now. But one pocket of confusion remains. Lots of Republicans right now seem to be unsure whether to praise Nelson Mandela or call him a commie terrorist. I was, on that point, shocked to see former Speaker Newt Gingrich not only praising Mandela, but actually going on CNN to defend Mandela's ties to communist activists who were partners in the fight against apartheid when the U.S. was too busy embracing the regime as a Cold War ally in Africa. Now, in general, regardless of many of their past views, GOP leaders have been saying the right things, even if their base is furious about it. But I guess Mandela was always confusing to the Republicans. If you're a Republican, there were always two schools of thought. You could go with the Republican senators in 1986 who voted in favor of sanctions on the apartheid government, or you could go with the Republican intellectuals in Washington who vigorously defended the apartheid regime and favorable policies toward it. From Nixon's offensively named tar baby option policy to St. Reagan, who not only vetoed congressional sanctions, which was overridden by the Republican Senate majority and Democratic House, but he recruited the South African foreign minister from the all-white nationalist government to call U.S. senators to urge them not to override his veto. I can't even fathom what would make Reagan think this was a brilliant plan, but I suspect that we would be seeing impeachment proceedings underway right now if the U.S. president today, Obama, of course, tried to enlist for, let's say, for comparison, Iran's foreign minister to make personal calls to members of Congress on not raising nuclear sanctions. It would be nonsensical at minimum. It just doesn't make sense to ask the government of the person that the country's trying to sanction to call them and hold off sanctions while you're trying to achieve policy objectives. And the Reagan administration claimed it was doing its own sanctions, so this makes even less sense. But in any case, it's certainly quite curious to me how Republican internet commenters this week, who are always ready to complain when anyone seeks to introduce nuance to discussion of famous white historical figures and leaders, say Thomas Jefferson or George Washington or any of those folks, even though those people also held problematic views in addition to some of their better positions and records for which we hail them today. But as soon as the discussion turns to someone like Nelson Mandela or Barack Obama during his presidential campaigns, these same commenters are eager to make sure that, quote unquote, the truth about these figures, their past associations or their problematic views, is brought to light and even emphasized against the good. The idea is that they, if anyone says anything, you know, even completely just a bromide about how great Nelson Mandela was and how inspiring he was, people have been flipping out about this and saying that he was a communist and a terrorist, and how could they be forgetting this, and he was a murderer, and you know, this is unacceptable to praise him. The man, a revered global figure, has just passed away, and they're busy trying to make sure that everyone knows that he was a complicated person. Now, the reality is that most historical figures are indeed complex figures, and they often make mistakes or hang out with some of the quote-unquote wrong people at some point in their lives. But it's absurd and racist to try to hold everyone to a standard where white figures are revered and off-limits for discussion, for accurate discussion, while black figures must be torn down and cannot be celebrated for even a moment without complaints. You know, the same people were upset that people would say, oh, Barack Obama in 2008, oh, he's so inspiring. You know, he's such a great positive example. And they'd be busy saying, no, well, he once knew someone who was a terrorist a long time ago. You know, guilt by association, etc. And never, ever, ever applying that same standard to white historical figures. That's why this is racist. One hallmark of racism is when you take something that applies to pretty much all human beings, and then you try to make it specific to a group. So, for example, you say that, you know, and if you're talking about the problems, the political problems and instability in various developing nations, and then you try to make it sound like it's an African problem, as opposed to a problem that affects all countries of a certain economic strata, or generally all countries. And it goes the same way here, that if you try to say, well, black leaders have problematic associations, that's true in the sense that all leaders have problematic associations. That's just the facts on the ground. That's just the reality of the situation. But for various reasons, these folks are unwilling to see that there might possibly be a similarity there across demographic lines, and they only want to bring attention to it when it's from black leaders or other people of color in leadership positions. And this is very problematic, and you can't say that it's not racist. It's not, you know, I'm sure there are some people who are saying, oh, Bill, you can't say that's racist. That's, you know, it might be misguided, but it's not racist. But no, that's the problem. Even if you don't think you're a bigot, if you hold a view, if you're the type of person who says that we can't discuss the nuances and complexities and downsides of white historical figures, but we can discuss them about blacks, even if you don't make that distinction out loud, but that's just how it happens to fall, that's at minimum subconscious racism, even if you're not overtly a white supremacist, which I'm sure a lot of people don't consider themselves to be that. But this is part of the problem. If you're going to apply one standard to one group and one standard to the other, that is at its core racism, and you cannot get around that. You cannot escape the fact that that's a racist way of looking at it. You know, and let's talk a little bit more about the Mandela associations and why this is agitating so much. So, of course, you know, the accusation was that he was a violent radical and that he associated with communists, and you hear Fidel Castro's name being brought up a lot. But let's just be real about this for a second. The Cold War mentality produced a lot of tangled, unlikely, and unfortunate alliances all around, for both the Americans and the Soviets. Nelson Mandela was not himself a communist, but he was willing to work with communists in South Africa and elsewhere who shared a core principle of anti-colonialism, anti-imperialism, and often, but not always, a unitary nationalism, which was his philosophy. Now, Lenin, the founding father of the Soviet Union, certainly had a range of terrible policies as the leader of a country. But before he became a dictator, he was an influential contributor to communist theories. And that's the important point there, because regardless of his policy examples later, he wrote a lot of theories, and a lot of people in developing nations maybe had never even been to the Soviet Union, or hadn't necessarily, if they had been, had not been exposed to the darker sides of the early Soviet and, of course, later Soviet policies. Many of them were introduced through theory and remained fundamentally in the theoretical realm as they were choosing how to identify in their various national struggles. So many people were following his theories, and his biggest contribution toward communism went toward explaining the merger of colonial economics and political imperialism. So other thinkers were often still obsessed with overthrowing industrial governments in Europe, and Lenin was actually raising some pointed criticisms of colonialism and explaining how the extractive relationship was harming poor and working class people, both in the colonized and colonizer nations. Now, even some of those theories were problematic in that his primary focus was that decolonization, he felt, would help the class struggle domestically and would provide fewer nationalistic distractions. That was his core motivation. But at least he was talking about it, and he put the Soviet Union on a path toward helping anti-colonialism and decolonization movements, right? So many people in the developing world joined communist movements in the 1920s, 1930s, 1940s, and later out of a sense that Lenin's theories offered the best route to political and economic independence for their home countries. More broadly, they saw communism as a way toward a more egalitarian and inclusive society than the divide and conquer political strategies that of the occupying powers and the economic inequality that these powers were fostering as they created ruling elites in these countries, whether they were white or native. Now, the Soviet Union was actually quite progressive in terms of the social front compared to much of the West. But as we know, they were deeply flawed in most other areas, right? And they were certainly extremely brutal. But put yourself in the mindset of the perspective of someone who was already living under a brutal, unequal, and impoverished colonial occupation or post-colonial system like the apartheid regime in South Africa, which lasts from approximately 1948 to very early 1990s, right? So put yourself in that mindset, brutal, unequal, impoverished, and you're looking at the different systems on offer. Yeah, the Soviet Union was often impoverished and certainly brutal, but it was in many respects looked like a better model than what the colonial powers were offering. So it makes sense from that point of view to consider communism as a way out. It offers self-determination. It offers a path toward industrialization, because that was the big thing in Russia, and then in particularly in China, was this idea of converting societies that weren't already industrial into industrial states so that then they could have the social and economic revolution that was part of the original Marxian theories, which were oriented toward industrial societies, and these colonial states were generally not industrial societies. So you've got that self-determination angle, you've got that industrialization angle, and you've got the promise of widely distributed and improved living standards that were probably higher than what colonialism or apartheid were offering, right? So they might be less advanced standards of living, and their growth potential might be less than, say, a well-regulated and politically free market capitalism, but that wasn't really on offer. The colonial capitalist system was more like mercantilism of old. It was definitely not beneficial to the colonized people, and it was not a way forward. The Soviet Union, while again very brutal, did improve standards of living in the Soviet Union, in the areas that it took over after World War II, and in its satellites. By and large, people's standards of living, on the whole, for most people, went up. Did it end up, you know, hitting ration points and various other chokeholds on the economy that limit growth potential? Absolutely. But again, you're not looking at it from the perspective of coming from an industrialized European or North American society. We're looking at it from the perspective of someone who's under the thumb of colonial rule, and there is extreme income inequality, and the benefits of colonialism economically are not flowing to the people at the bottom. And that was the system that the all-white apartheid system was keen on preserving. So if you're looking at it from that perspective, you can see why communism in the Soviet Union would be a model that people would certainly be willing to consider over, say, capitalism. Now, interestingly, many communists in emerging nations during their independence and early post-colonial movements actually tried to befriend the United States because they saw it as a freer alternative to following the Soviet model. And they believed Americans would be sympathetic to the struggles of people who wanted freedom from colonialism, national independence, and upward social mobility for all. Those are core foundational 1776 values of the United States of America. And a lot of these folks thought, yeah, This is a friend. They will align with us. This is, you know, all part and parcel of the same thing. We're all part of the same struggle. It's just our turn now. The United States will help us. But unfortunately, the Americans were often too blinded by ideological taxonomies and concerns over maintaining business interests of American multinational firms operating in these developing nations. This resulted in classifying everyone as either red or not red, even if that meant opposing friendly movements that I identified as predominantly communist during their resistance phase against very oppressive colonial and post-colonial regimes like the apartheid regime. It also resulted in the United States supporting brutally undemocratic regimes who happen to identify as anti-communist, usually because their main national opposition was communist, or because it was a convenient means of acquiring military aid to suppress their populations and maintain their rule. So Nelson Mandela wasn't communist himself, but in the communists, he saw brothers in arms who shared many of the same beliefs and were willing to help oppose the apartheid regime of the Afrikaner white minority rulers. The United States was ambivalent at the best of times toward fighting against the apartheid system, and it actively refused to oppose the apartheid government at the worst of times. Rather than criticizing these past associations, as we're considering the passing of Mandela, Americans should be instead reflecting on how ideological blinders have warped our global relations in the past, and we should be thinking pretty seriously about what we can do to ensure that we're helping the right people and not helping the wrong people in the future. The more that we provide help to those who need it, and the less we offer aid and comfort to oppressive regimes, the less likely people will be to join radical and violent movements or to associate with movements and ideological groupings that we consider harmful. The United States has got to lead by example, not by lecture, and we've got to help economically and politically oppressed populations wherever we can. That, fundamentally, is my takeaway from the legacy of Nelson Mandela, and I hope that that's been informative and thought-provoking for the rest of you who are listening. Arsenal for Democracy will be right back in just a moment from arsenalfordemocracy.com and WVUD. I'm Bill Humphrey, and you're listening to Arsenal for Democracy. Be sure to check out the new website at arsenalfordemocracy.com to get additional content that I haven't covered on the show and previews of upcoming segments on shows. arsenalfordemocracy.com. I'm Bill Humphrey. Joining me here on Arsenal for Democracy after about almost a year, I think, since he was last on the show, is Neil Carter from Maryland. Neil, welcome back to the program.
Thanks, Bill. It's been far too long. Great to be back.
Yeah, so after I had launched the new Arsenal for Democracy website and all the associated social media accounts, I was checking Twitter more than I had been, and I noticed, because I follow you, obviously, you're a friend of the show and everything, I noticed that you were participating in this hashtag Millennials of Color, and you didn't actually start it, but you were definitely a vocal participant in it. Mm-hmm. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about whose idea that was and kind of what the premise of it was and what the conversation developed, how that developed from there.
Sure. The conversation was started by a friend of mine who lives in New York City. Her name is Sadette Harry. Her Twitter username is at Black Amazon, all one word. She started it mainly due to the fact that there had been a number of clickbait articles, which are basically articles that are created by folks to on any range of any news site to basically get, you know, clicks for their major website, be it Gawker, be it IO9, be it Slate, be it what have you. And there were a number of articles that were written that were basically omitting millennials from the conversation about, you know, when having conversations about millennials, and then even worse, discussing the issues that millennials deal with. And Sadette was coming from a standpoint of women of color millennials, specifically Black women of color millennials, dealing with the ranging of issues that they have to deal with when, you know, in terms of the book that recently came out, Lean In, right, and some other things. So, you know, with all these articles that have come out, it seems like there's an article almost written almost every week.
Yeah, these
it seems like
trend pieces. Yeah, and so they seem to focus on the experience of white millennials specifically most of the time, but they don't say that. They just say it as all millennials, right?
Right, exactly.
So this was kind of a way of highlighting some of the specific challenges facing millennials of color, not just millennials as a whole, right?
Correct. That's correct.
Okay, so there were a number of angles that different people were bringing up, mostly speaking from their own experiences. And one of those that I noticed throughout as a common theme was about student debt. Now, obviously, student debt is something that we hear about a lot as affecting all millennials, and it does. But there's been some suggestion that there is a distinction between the white middle class families for whom it's a very expensive, possibly too expensive luxury versus the people of color for whom student aid was originally intended in many cases, or at least low income folks, and many people of color fall in that category. And that, you know, that for I think I saw some statistic that while many white young people would be able to go, of relatively affluent or middle class means would be able to go to at least some level of school without financial aid. You know, it was just helping them get into the better end schools or the higher, more expensive schools. But for a lot of people of color, young people of color, the student aid and financial aid was the difference between going or not going. So I was wondering if you could speak a little bit to that angle and how that is particularly impacting millennials of color relative to, say, other millennials.
Sure. You know, I think that college is not getting any less expensive. The options to go to achieve higher education are becoming fewer and far and in between, no matter what statistics you look at. When millennials of color apply for these colleges, or I guess I should frame them as higher institutions, they are automatically segmented into, you know, subcategories and subcategories of those subcategories based on their financial structure. Sometimes some universities, they won't tell you this, but some universities look at personality reports and criminal statistics in the communities that they're, you know, that these applicants live in and things like that based on their last name, not even seeing a picture of these people.
Right.
And saying, and, you know, so when it comes to financial aid, it's the same exact thing. Financial aid is a structure that was built predominantly, as you so eloquently put it, to assist low-income folks, predominantly persons of color, to achieve higher education. And when a person of color, specifically millennials, because we're dealing with it the most right now, either apply for financial aid or are dealing with financial aid being postgraduate, you know, trying to pay financial aid dues after the fact and things like that, you know, it amazes me that we're automatically seen as angry and uneducated when that's the one thing that we're applying to try to get. We are trying to get an education and trying to uplift ourselves, and we're basically getting the rug taken from under us by these financial aid institutions. They are structured in a way that benefits them more so than the millennial that is applying for it. And as a result, that millennial's debt increases, especially in households where that millennial may be the first millennial. I mean, how many times have you ever heard this? I'm the first of my household, to graduate from high school. If you're the first to graduate from high school, then it's automatic. Then you're automatically segmented into a certain financial structure, you know, by that higher education institution that forces you to get a higher rate to pay towards for financial aid. Yes, you'll get the grants, you'll get all the, you know, you'll get all the perks initially, but then they basically feed you, in my opinion, a bunch of lies because they say, you know, you're going to get all these great perks, but then they don't tell you the end result, which is the massing debt that you end up incurring.
And I would imagine that it then cycles right into the, you know, other external structural issues that remain a problem. So the fact that, you know, it's harder to get a job if you're a person of color than your white peer who has the same level of education and graduated at the same time. And then it's going to be harder to get the same pay scale probably. And then it's going to be more likely that you're going to lose the job, or if you aren't able to find a job, you know, or, you know, something like that, you're going to end up in a structurally unemployed, long-term chronic unemployment situation. We know that unemployment affects populations, particularly black populations, but other populations of color as well in the United States at a much higher rate than white populations. So when we talk, you know, here on Arsenal for Democracy about how the student debt situation is set up so that you can't default on the debt and you have to pay it even when you don't have a job to be able to earn the money to pay for it, that is something that affects pretty much all millennials, but it's going to affect millennials of color more than white millennials.
Yes, that's correct.
Now, you also wanted to talk a little bit about your own personal experiences and how some of this has affected you, the generational gap between, you know, that we talk about sometimes on the show with regard to the baby boomers who won't leave the workforce, you know, despite the New York Times article recently about them complaining about getting pushed from the workforce. The reality is that a lot of these baby boomers aren't leaving when they should and are therefore not freeing up job openings for the folks below them. Of course, then they start complaining about the long-term fiscal health of Social Security, but can't pay into Social Security if you don't have a job. So you were going to talk a little bit about, and you had talked about it on the in this hashtag conversation, mm-hmm. about how the you know, that generational aspect affected you as a millennial of color.
Yeah. So, you know, I'm a political consultant, you know, by trade. I run a political consulting firm here in Maryland. And I can tell you, Bill, that a lot of the things I run into are, one of the biggest, I think, stepping stones that I've had to consistently get over, and I'm doing the best that I can, you know, with the team that I have, is this generational step. There are a lot of firms around the country that are run by baby boomers who, you know, and no disrespect to them, you know, not knocking the work that they did, because, you know, the political consulting field would not be where it is right now without them. So I can't take away from the work that they put in. But at the same time, you know, the political field, you know, specifically the political consulting field, has shifted. It has evolved. And as it has evolved, as the voting populace has, you know, as their issues have changed, as elected officials have changed, as candidates have changed, you have the capacity for these political consulting firms to also change when in fact they're not. You have candidates and elected officials alike who are, you know, looking to get elected. They are looking for the easy way. And quite frankly, the easy way for them is to go where their quote unquote friends are. And their friends are these baby boomer political consulting firms that have been around for, you know, decades on decades on decades and haven't really gotten out of the baby boomer type issues and baby boomer type tools that are quite frankly not the 21st century.
Right. And then, of course, they wonder why no young people or people of color show up at any of their campaign rallies.
Right. Exactly. They don't come to their campaign rallies. They don't volunteer for their, you know, campaigns. They don't show up when they're talking about issues. When they are elected officials, they don't come out for their town halls or anything like that. They wonder why, you know, young people just don't show up. And then they say things like, I mean, how many times have we heard this? Young people don't vote. Young people don't come out. Young people don't do this. Young people were blamed for the 2010 election. Young people were blamed for the 2004 election. Young people were blamed for the 2000 election. And the issue isn't young people. It's never been young people. It's that these candidates and elected officials aren't adapting to the 21st century. And they're hiring these firms that are, quite frankly, in the Jurassic period when it comes to, you know, tools and systems that can get them elected in the 21st century, not the Jurassic period. And, you know, they're never going to get, you know, young people that they care so much about, you know, to the polls and to their town halls and, you know, to work for their campaigns if they don't start hiring political consulting firms that have young people on staff, that are run by young people, that have worked on issues around young people, that are focusing on issues now, not issues then. Because Right. Let's face it, issues then won't get them elected. Issues then won't get them reelected. It's the issues of the now that are going to get them elected and reelected.
The now and the future. And yeah, I think, you know, you're raising good points here. It's a different set of issues. And it's also, the problem is not, for the most part, with the millennials. I mean, you're looking at a generation that following 9/11 became, you know, the most pro-volunteer generation, the most civically minded generation we've seen since like World War II. We've seen, you know, that they have this, we have this strong view in general that although we might be skeptical about the government's ability to deliver certain services, we believe that there is a role for a strong central government and strong local governments and things like that. And so, you know, there's a role that a lot of folks, especially on the left, could be campaigning on. And in general, they're not making that outreach that they need to be making. I think you raised some good points there. Well, we are almost about out of time here, but you know, I would encourage people to check out the hashtag Millennials of Color for a much broader conversation. As he said, Black Amazon at Black Amazon was the handle of the woman who started that hashtag. There's a whole bunch of issues that we didn't even get time to touch touch on today, you know, of how these issues that in general, they do affect pretty much all millennials for the most part, but they affect millennials of color in certain ways that they don't affect white millennials as much to the same degree, or sometimes even at all. You know, we could talk all day about how the internship, unpaid internship problem that we talk about on this show pretty frequently, you know, is going to impact low income millennials of color more than it's going to impact white millennials or, you know, more affluent millennials, certainly. But, you know, lots of issues that we didn't get to today. Neil, did you want to plug anything, Twitter, website, company, anything like that?
Thank you, Bill. I guess, you know, you can follow me on Twitter at Neil Carter. It's pretty, you know, I don't, you know, no special characters. And you can find my political consulting firm on the web at newviewproductions.org. All one word.
Well, Neil, thank you so much for coming on Arsenal for Democracy to talk about some of these important issues today.
Thanks for having me.
Arsenal for Democracy will be right back in just a moment. I'm Bill Humphrey, and you're listening to Arsenal for Democracy. I'd like to talk a little bit today about the federal minimum wage and the concept of the minimum wage in general. I think this is obviously something that we've talked about quite a number of times on Arsenal for Democracy, but it's something that has come up again as the proposals move forward in Congress, or may or may not move forward, but we hope are moving forward toward raising the federal minimum wage. Now, there's a lot of angles to come at this. You can talk about how much it should be raised by. You could talk about whether it should be raised. And there's some very interesting data out there about comparative minimum wages and prevailing wages in other countries. For example, Australia's minimum wage, if you convert it to U.S. dollars, is twice what the U.S. minimum wage is per hour. And they have lower unemployment, higher labor force participation, and a faster economic growth than the United States. But there's one particular angle that always seems to come up every time about whether or not we should even have a minimum wage. That's the one that really troubles me, and that's one that I wanted to talk about. Usually, you know, in your Econ 101 or Econ 102, you might get a conservative-leaning professor who's going to throw some arguments at you and some studies. You know, I was flipping through some studies that were purporting to explain how the minimum wage was going to cause a higher unemployment. And at the very end of the study, it said, oh, well, actually, we're not sure if this is a factor at all. And if at all, it seems to be a pretty small factor. The studies that I've been seeing through work and various other sources more recently have shown that, particularly in other countries, but also in the United States, best case scenario, you get some pretty significant growth out of it. Worst case scenario, it doesn't kill jobs. It actually creates jobs, maybe at a slightly slower rate, but then it balances out because those people can, you know, buy more goods and pay for more services, and therefore those things, those industries and sectors have to create more jobs, which down the line leads to better jobs for everyone at a higher wage rate. But let's really laser in today on that issue of whether or not we should have a minimum wage. Now, you might think, oh, well, why wouldn't we have a minimum wage? We've had a federal minimum wage for a long time. Many states have minimum wages that are actually higher than the wages in the at the national level. There's even countries like Germany that still don't have a minimum wage, although it's worth noting that they have very closely regulated and cooperative industrial labor relations that have been able to negotiate wages for the most part in the past on a wide scale without the need for a minimum wage. But that's not something that's really been feasible in the United States. But I bring this up because every time there's talk of raising the minimum wage, you get people saying that we should abolish it altogether. The core premise of this argument is, of course, it's a supply and demand thing, that if the cost of labor goes up, then that means that it costs more per person to make a new hire or to retain someone you've already hired. And therefore, if the price goes up, then the businesses will demand, will have demand for fewer workers, even if the supply of workers remains the same, that they will have to make cutbacks or not hire as many people. And particularly, you hear this argument that there's going to be cutbacks and job losses, right? So the claim here is that you should abolish the minimum wage because more people would be able to get jobs if wages weren't so high, right? Because businesses could hire more people with the same amount of money. And, you know, I acknowledge that some people making this claim are just kind of making it manipulatively. They don't actually believe it. They just say it, whatever. But I do see people who seem to genuinely believe it. And that's troubling to me because it's really not a legitimate argument. So let's think about logically how it doesn't make sense. So, sure, we could employ everyone in the country if, for the sake of argument, people were willing to accept getting paid, say, pennies an hour, right? But that's not really the point of having a job. So paying everyone to work at a very low wage rate, in this example, pennies an hour, does get everyone employed. You have full employment under that scenario if people were willing to accept that. But that's not the goal of having a job, which is why people wouldn't actually accept that in practice, right? But again, even if they were, that's not the reason that people have a job. The goal of getting a job, the core goal, if you strip it all away, at minimum, is to be able to support, feed, clothe, and shelter yourself, and often, though not for everyone, do the same for a family. You want to provide for yourself, provide for your family. That's the core goal of getting a job. Unless you're, I guess, some super bored person who was born rich, your job in that case is to have something to do and be entertained, right? But for most people, at least initially in their careers, the main fundamental rock bottom objective of having a job is to be able to provide for yourself and to provide for people who depend on you. So the problem with this argument that if the wages were, you know, infinitely lower, we could hire everybody in the country, I don't understand how someone believes that, because the goal of promoting higher employment has never been just to get everyone jobs, even if the jobs don't pay them enough to be able to do anything. The goal of full employment has always been we want as many people working as possible, and we want them working at wages at which they can sustain themselves. Ending the minimum wage would not create millions of jobs because people wouldn't be willing to accept that because it doesn't provide enough money to pay for your basic needs. If you can't feed, clothe, and shelter yourself, then that job is not working for you. And in fact, it's an opportunity cost. That's another economic concept, which is saying that as long as I am working this job that doesn't pay me enough, I am not able to be working a different job that could pay me more, or I am not able to be collecting federal benefits, which is why sometimes people will go on to those. Because again, if the job is not paying you enough to sustain yourself, you're going to have to count on those benefits. So in the system that we have, abolishing the minimum wage would simply put more people than ever on government benefits. And those are very expensive too. And I'm assuming that conservatives who oppose the minimum wage also don't want that outcome either. That is the reality of the situation. If you cut the minimum wage and eliminate it entirely, you just end up with a lot of people on very expensive government benefits. With the minimum wage, the government doesn't pay anything directly. It just orders the businesses to raise it to an arbitrary level, and that is the amount that people are getting paid, and then hopefully people can support themselves, right? So if you don't have a minimum wage, and then you don't have a social safety net either with government programs, then it creates an expensive and awful, you know, Dickensian or Malthusian nightmare land with mass poverty and out of control levels of crime and associated violence. Eventually, of course, that's going to negatively impact businesses too. So you can either pay for this social cost through a minimum wage, you can pay for it through massive government spending programs, or you can pay for it through businesses being dampened by no one being able to buy anything and everyone having to commit crimes to get by and make a living, which impacts businesses eventually, even for the people who do have money. You know, without accounting for the lost and reduced purchasing power of the consumer base that would result from not having a minimum wage, the simple reality is that if you were getting paid, you know, only a couple dollars an hour as your full-time job that you had to work, you know, 60 hours a week or more, that literally isn't going to pay for anything substantial. And if there aren't government benefits either in that scenario, then you turn to a life of crime. And we know this because we saw it happen before. That's what happened in the last three decades of the 19th century. Now, I went and double-checked this to make sure I wasn't just, you know, full of hot air or whatever. I was thinking, okay, let's think logically about a scenario where we had wages going down and we had a deflationary period that results from wages going down, and we had an excessive supply in the labor market, and there wasn't a floor that could keep the minimum, the lowest level wages from going down because we didn't have a minimum wage at that point. And I said, okay, I know 1873, we start having a long period of recessions. There's another dip in 1893 approximately. And you have this long, almost 30-year period of deflationary pressures that result from having no wage floors and a very constant stream of immigration that was, you know, putting more people into the labor force and making wages very competitive downward. There was no floor in that situation, and the expectation, my hypothesis would be that in a scenario where you have that happening, that there's going to be massive crime happening and a big crime wave breaking out. And in fact, that's true. It was very easy to find. I pretty much just Googled, you know, rise in crime in 1880s or whatever. And there was a study that was released in the early 1900s about the huge wave in violent crime that arose in the 1890s and 1880s. Those last two decades of the 19th century were particularly noteworthy at the time for their extremely high levels of criminal activity and violence breaking out because people were destitute, they were desperate, they couldn't make enough money working, and that they had to do what they had to do to survive. That's why we have a minimum wage. That's why we have these government safety net programs. And we, you know, ultimately, I'd say we want to raise the minimum wage to a level where people don't need to rely on programs if they're working full time. They shouldn't have to have government programs. And that would probably be around $11 an hour if you look at the federal poverty line right now. But that's not a realistic proposal that's on the table right now. And plus, it's very unlikely that the minimum wage raise is going to go through the U.S. House under Republican control next year. But the minimum wage is $7.25 an hour right now. It hasn't gone up since 2009. The last legislation changing it was passed in 2007. It hadn't gone up for a long time before then either. It's way below where it should be. But, you know, if we're not going to raise it, we sure as heck better not lower it. And that's, you know, something that I wanted to go over because I see this misinformation out there about that and people aren't thinking through logically about the consequences of it. So I want to make sure people actually understand the consequences of that. The other story that we've been following, of course, is the unemployment insurance benefits. Very similar situation here. It's something that we've talked about time and again here on Arsenal for Democracy. This idea that you have the people who want to extend long-term unemployment insurance benefits for people who have been chronically out of work. And you also want to, you have the people who are arguing on the other side, your Rand Pauls most recently, and a number of other people saying that extending unemployment insurance somehow hurts the people who are actually on it. Again, this is a fundamental misunderstanding of kind of how the labor market works and economic psychology and hiring practices. You know, as I said, something we've talked about on the show before, some of this is going to be rehashed from some of our very earliest episodes in the end of 2011. But I'd also recommend that everyone check out an article that was posted on the Atlantic website explaining why Rand Paul is wrong here. So the reality of the situation is that, yes, ideally you don't want people to be on unemployment insurance benefits indefinitely, right? But the fact is right now, the economy is still not growing fast enough, even after all this time, to provide enough coverage for the people that have been unemployed since the beginning or since near the beginning of the recession, as well as the people who are coming into the workforce each year, graduating or re-entering it by other means, things like that. The economy is not growing fast enough. There are several more people looking for jobs than there are job opportunities available. And so you can't just take away unemployment insurance benefits like we saw North Carolina do earlier this year. You can't arbitrarily take that away and that will magically make people get jobs. It is not a cushy life living on unemployment insurance benefits. Those are a very small dollar amount that will maybe cover your rent and your food for the month. At best, you know, it's not a huge amount. It's certainly not living in the lap of luxury. And to be able to qualify it, you have to be able to demonstrate to the government that you are consistently and continually looking for work. So there are people who are, you know, going to be affected if these extensions don't pass at the end of the year. These folks are unable to get through, you know, unable to find work, and they've been looking, consistently looking for work for 2 years or more now. If they're coming to the end of that 99 weeks point, that means that they've been on unemployment insurance trying to look for a job for about 2 years, possibly more in some cases, right? You cannot collect your benefits if you're not looking for work. And as anyone who's had to look for any significant period of time knows, or even most people who weren't immediately, you know, snapped up between jobs, you understand that the process of looking for work is a pretty active full-time process. It's basically your full-time job. That's what unemployment insurance is. It's not a check to sit around doing nothing. It's a specific payment that is being made to finance and subsidize your ability to go out and look for work, right? That you don't have to go try to get a job at McDonald's or compete with all the teenage kids with the minimum wage jobs, that you're going to be able to find something that's actually at your working level and will pay the expenses that you need to pay. Because you can't just accept any job if you've got various other obligations that you've got to pay for. And many of those companies won't even hire you if you're overqualified. So the unemployment insurance check is basically a payment that says, hey, keep looking. Here's some money so that you can literally afford to survive to, you know, while you're still looking for work. And that's the concept behind this. It doesn't it doesn't keep people from looking for work because they have to demonstrate that they have been looking. The other problem is that the longer people have been out of the workforce, the less likely they are to be hired by various companies. Companies will say, you know, a lot of them have automated processes now. If they're large companies, they won't even look at the resume if their software detects an employment gap of more than, you know, 6 months or so. There have been studies that have been done on this. And we know that there is a significant deterrent. The longer people are out of the workforce, it's harder and harder to get them back in. Now, many women, of course, face this pressure, setting aside market cycles. They face this problem when they try to re-enter the workforce after being mothers for a long time, or even a couple years. That becomes very difficult. And it's the same thing across the board for a lot of people, not just women, who have been returning to the workforce after becoming moms. This is something that affects a lot of people, and it prevents them from getting jobs no matter how hard they look. You know, eventually, hopefully, they get hired when the economy is back, you know, roaring along and the employers are desperate enough to find new employees that they start looking at these employees again. It's not right. It's, you know, I would argue it's kind of morally wrong, but that's the reality of how business in the United States operates. And that the need for an extension is a recognition that this is how this operates. There aren't the jobs available, and those jobs that are available are going to people who've been unemployed for shorter periods of time rather than people who've been unemployed for longer periods of time and are depending on the extension of these emergency benefits. Cutting these benefits or failing to extend them does not magically get everyone employed. It does not encourage people to go look for work in a way that they weren't doing before. Everyone is trying to work. The basic psychology for most people, is that they would prefer to be working and be a productive member of society that supports themselves than not. And and if they're sitting around or whatever and aren't looking for work, in all likelihood, more times than not, it's not out of any kind of laziness. It's probably because they're depressed, because there have been a lot of studies showing about the long-term depression effects that are linked to chronic unemployment and long-term unemployment. Again, if it gets harder and harder to find work and you still have to keep looking, it's going to get more and more discouraging, and it's going to make a lot of people feel pretty bad about themselves, and it's going to be very hard to look for work. None of these are factors that justify letting the unemployment insurance benefits lapse. This is something that needs to be extended, and it seems like it's pretty straightforward economics to me, even if Rand Paul and his libertarian friends don't seem to understand that. Before we close this week's episode, I wanted to take 1 minute to talk about something that won't happen but would be fun to consider. I would much rather have Nancy Pelosi as president than Hillary Clinton, even though I would prefer to nominate someone much younger than either of them because I'd like to make a clean break toward issues that affect younger people and the global future. But here's why I would prefer Pelosi to Clinton. Pelosi is a proven liberal and an effective one at that. As has been said before, if we had been under a parliamentary system from January 2009 to the end of 2010, she, as prime minister in that scenario, would have been cemented as one of America's most legendary prolific leaders just on the number of major bills passed out of the House. Because of the obstruction of the U.S. Senate in those 2 years, it's really easy to forget what she actually achieved. She passed a strong health reform bill, which the Senate then watered down, and she also passed a cap and trade law, which the Senate ignored. And she passed a lot more beyond that. But that's two career signature liberal and Democratic pieces in just 2 years that a lot of people in her position previously had not been able to pass. A bold liberal who gets the job done and gets it done right? I'd love to see that in a president. That's my minute. Thanks for listening to Arsenal for Democracy for December 9th, 2013. The show is recorded at my studio in Newton, Massachusetts weekly and is available for download from arsenalfordemocracy.com on Tuesdays. You can also hear a repeat of it on the air in Delaware from 91.3 FM WVUD and WVUD HD1 Newark, and you can stream it at WVUD.org every Wednesday night at 6 p.m. Eastern. Special thanks to my voiceover man, Justin. You can follow his work at the Digitized Ramblings of an 8-Bit Animal from 8BitAnimal.com. And thanks to my guest, Neil Carter. From my studio in Newton, Massachusetts, I'm Bill Humphrey, and I approve this message. Good night.